This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This is Ramona Africa, and you're listening to KBOO, KBOO 90.7 on your dial. KBOO is the exact example of the community taking charge of itself on the move.
Taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. Cha-cha-cha. It's the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, KBOO's all-vinyl guilty pleasure. Monday nights, midnight to 1 a.m. on 90.7 FM stereo and around the world at kboo.fm.
We are here tonight to show solidarity with prison strikers at Pelican Bay Correctional Institute in Northern California.
Woo! We have the biggest prison system in the world. We have the highest incarceration rates in the world. If we have a section of the population that's that big, that disenfranchised, and is being dehumanized to the extent that they're living in little cells that are 6 by 8 foot, 23 out of 24 hours of the day in that cell. We're looking at a situation that's going to be popping off pretty soon here. And I think we're starting to feel the first rumblings of that with this prison strike right now.
On Prison Pipeline, July 22nd, hear the rally at the Portland Justice Center in solidarity with the striking prisoners. That's Prison Pipeline, July 22nd at 6:30 p.m.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland Mayor Charlie Hales calls for removal of homeless advocates camped in front of City Hall.
An arrested Occupy Mount Tabor activist makes his initial court appearance tomorrow.
An OHSU scientist reveals new research into ADHD. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, July 22nd, 2013. I'm Angelique O'Rourke.
And I'm John Rasmussen. Mayor Charlie Hales is threatening houseless protesters in front of Portland City Hall with forcible removal tomorrow after eviction notices were posted last Friday. Houseless people have been camped in front of City Hall for over 18 months, and a vigil to end the camping ban in Portland. Individuals living in front of City Hall say camping there is a right of free speech and that a lack of services for houseless people perpetuates the problem. The Right to Dream 2, a rest area for houseless people, has accrued fines of over $25,000 for illegal camping, which under the camping ban is considered recreational. The city is framing the eviction as a public safety issue. They cite the number of calls to police over the last 6 months complaining of drug use and harassment of people walking into City Hall. Mayor Hales has repeated the point that evicting the protesters is not about the economy, free speech, or houselessness, which he says are different issues. The Portland Business Alliance says it's about the economy and livability downtown. Downtown city sidewalks are designated as high pedestrian traffic areas, which the mayor says he is invoking in order to evict the campers and clean up the sidewalks.
Court dates for the Occupy Mount Tabor Reservoir arrests are scheduled to start tomorrow. The occupation at Southeast 60th and Hawthorne is in protest of Portland City Council's plan to privatize our Bull Run water. KBOO's Joe Meyer spoke with Michael Mayo, the first activist to be arrested, and filed this report.
The citizen group Friends of the Reservoirs have been fighting City Hall for more than a decade over control of our Bull Run water. When the new city council, led by Hales and Fish, declared full steam ahead on privatization of our Bull Run water, activists turned to civil disobedience. Here's Michael Mayo, the first one arrested at Mount Tabor Reservoir Number 6.
When the federal government makes an unfunded mandate, and in our case, we can prove that it's completely irrational and contrary to common sense, then we do expect our local officials to say no. No federal government, we will not allow you to come and cover our reservoirs when there's no need to do it. And when you put a fine on us, then we'll go to court and we will show in court that you cannot have a federal mandate that makes us spend hundreds of millions of dollars for water that is less safe and less pure. And that being the case, that's what we expect of them. We expect them to stand up for our ability to drink pure, clean water.
And have you yourself given testimony before City Hall in this regard?
Oh, two or three times.
And any happy effects?
No, there's been no effect at all.
Due to a miscommunication among organizers, Mr. Mayo found himself to be the lone protester and remained undeterred.
So at noon on July 12th, or a few minutes after, I was at Mount Tabor, ready to join the Occupy Mount Tabor movement. There was nobody there. There were a lot of police going back and around on their all-terrain vehicles.
So somebody got the word.
Yeah, they had closed off access to the upper reservoir except by foot. So in any case, I set up to demonstrate by putting up banners. I had one banner that hung from a pine tree, and another one, the bigger one, put in three stakes in the ground, which the ground in question was the unmown portion of the slope, where it just they leave it wild. So it didn't cover what might be called a lawn portion, or stop anybody from passing on one of the paths. It was just stuck in there to be visible on a steep slope. Well, I then told by the park rangers that they had concerns about it. I said, my defense will be, gentlemen, that this is a political act I am engaged in. When you are facing a breakdown in government and you proceed to civil disobedience, then you have an effort here to express something that's being made impossible by the usual channels. You then have that chance to have peaceable assembly to address grievances. And I was released from my being in jail at 5 o'clock in the morning on Saturday. I have a court date tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock, 1120 Southwest 3rd, at which I will be asked whether I'm innocent or guilty of refusing to obey a park ranger's order.
On the face of it, you did not really obey that.
Well, you know, there's this interesting interplay at work here. I compared it at the time with the people I was speaking to what happens to the people who the church decided in the 1400s were insufficiently orthodox in their beliefs. They handed them over to the secular arm and said to the secular arm, why, you are empowered to kill these people because they're heretics. No matter how it looks like you've broken the law, the Bill of Rights say that you have certain things you can do. You can peaceably assemble. You can make in a reasonable time, place, and manner, you can give political expression to your grievances. And that's what I'm saying. Found guilty of this trumped-up business, I intend not to pay a fine and will prefer instead the time in jail.
That was Michael Mayo, the first activist arrested at Mount Tabor. He plans on presenting his constitutional rights to a judge tomorrow morning at 9 a.m., 1120 Southwest 3rd Avenue. I'll see you there, and I'm Joe Meyer with KBOO News.
The annexation of West Hayden Island is making its way into the city's business. West Hayden Island is located beneath the I-5 bridge to Vancouver. The Port of Portland, which wishes to build a marine terminal there, pushed the move, which the City Planning and Sustainability Commission approved on July 9th. The matter now heads before the City Council, who must first vote on the island annexation before any development effort can move forward. According to the Marine Terminal Plan proposal, 300 of West Island's acres, 800 acres, would be developed. Critics of the plan say that the island is home to critical wildlife habitat and that the Port of Portland's marine terminal economic projections are overly optimistic. Additionally, the apparent death of the effort to build a new I-5 bridge has thrown a wrench into proceedings. Land use planning for the island's development was largely tied into the construction of the bridge, satisfying a mandate that traffic access be improved. Without a new bridge, how those stipulations will be satisfied is now in question. The city will consider the matter in October.
Commissioners at the Port of Vancouver will discuss the elements of a proposed oil export terminal that critics believe could pose health and safety risks to many who reside along both sides of the Columbia River. Climate Parents is a national group who has gathered 14,000 signatures in opposition of the project, which they'll be presenting to the commissioners tonight. Campaign Director Corinne Ball spoke with KBOO's Robin Ryan about tonight's action and about the vigil prior to the meeting as a show of solidarity with the community in Quebec where an oil train exploded earlier this month.
I'm talking with Corinne Ball. She is a local organizer with a group called Climate Parents, and they plan to present 14,000 signatures that stand opposed to a deal that the Port of Vancouver is discussing with a corporation called Tesoro. Can you tell me why?
The project that is being considered tonight would completely transform the Port of Vancouver into one of the West Coast's largest oil ports, and it would drastically increase carbon pollution, fueling droughts, wildfires, severe storms that we're seeing all over the world. We're talking about 360,000 barrels of crude oil every day along the Columbia River. That's 56 million metric tons of carbon pollution every year, which, just to put it into perspective, is almost as much as 12 million cars worth of greenhouse gas pollution. So not only that, we would see about 1,400 trains carrying oil by rail through neighborhoods every year. So tonight, we are going to go to the Port of Vancouver hearing and present 14,000 signatures that have been collected in Vancouver and also from people just around the country who are asking the court commissioners to say no to this project.
Can you talk about the vigil that's planned prior to your presentation?
Yes, so the vigil is being planned by Columbia Riverkeepers, and they are hosting the vigil from 6 to 6:30, and I will be there. Other members of Climate Parents will be there just to honor the victims and the survivors of the Quebec train that exploded and derailed in Quebec earlier this month and killed many, many people. It is the same kind of oil that would be transported by rail to this proposed port facility. So for us in the Pacific Northwest, we stand in solidarity with people in Quebec. We also look to our community to make solid safety decisions to make sure disasters like this don't happen anywhere and don't happen here.
You make a presentation tonight. At some point, there's going to be a response. How will you know if your efforts going into tonight have been successful?
The Port of Vancouver commissioners are expected to vote as soon as tomorrow about this proposal. And we are hoping that they take the community's concerns very seriously tonight and vote no on this proposal. We should know tomorrow or early this week if they're voting yes or no, or if they're going to have an extended timeline. My understanding of the talks with the oil companies is that the community has not been at the center of this issue. And that's one of the things that folks in Vancouver have been really concerned about, is making sure that the commission hears their feedback and hears their concerns and has time to reflect on this proposal and look at the environmental impacts and the community impacts this proposal would bring. And thus far, there has not been transparency from all parties on what the proposal will look like.
Corinne Ball with Climate Parents. Do you have a website you can direct our listeners to?
Our website is climateparents.org.
That's climateparents.org, and they're going to be having an event at the Port of Vancouver tonight. For KBOO News, this is Robin Ryan.
Efforts to manage a fire that began Saturday morning north of the Warm Springs Indian Reservation in Central Oregon are expected to change hands from the local bureau to state fire marshals tonight. The fire has nearly doubled in size and is described as about 20% contained and threatens as much as 39 square miles. Approximately 120 people from 40 homes in the Wolf Point subdivision remain evacuated after some residents were allowed to return to their homes Sunday afternoon. Firefighters contend humans caused the fire, but haven't yet determined by what means.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for free speech radio news after this newscast, followed by Labor Radio at 6. A program about working people, for working people, by working people. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather is expected to be hot, with high temperatures around 90 degrees. Lows tonight should be around 60 degrees.
It's now 5:15, which means it's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
One thing I've come to value in the last couple of years is the altruism and keen economic insights of the fourth richest man in America, Charles Koch. Even though Koch was raised rich and has now amassed a personal fortune of about $34 billion, he recently gave us a deeper sense of his true worth, measured not in dollars but in values. We want to do a better job of raising up the disadvantaged and the poorest in this country, he declared. Excellent thought. FDR couldn't have put it better. Noting that a big problem for the poor is that the powers that be, quote, keep throwing obstacles in their way, Koch cut to the chase, saying, we've got to clear those out. Yes, Charlie, I'm with you. Clear out such barriers as the offshoring of middle-class jobs, union busting, poorly funded schools, and the lack of affordable health care, housing, and child care. Good God, no, barked Koch. It turns out that he intends to help poor people by eliminating, ready, the minimum wage. Why? Because, explains this clueless son of the rich, having a wage floor, quote, reduces the mobility of labor. In case you don't dwell in the plutocratic, narcissistic, Ayn Randian fantasy land where the Kochs hang out, labor mobility is right-wing psychobabble for social Darwinism. Remove all remnants of America's economic safety net, they coldly theorize, while wallowing in their nests of luxury, and the poor will be freed to become billionaires. As Charles puts it, with no protections, the disadvantaged would have to scramble just to live, thus freeing them to, quote, start a business, drive a taxicab, become a hairdresser. This is Jim Hightower saying, what a visionary he is. Where you see massive, debilitating poverty, he sees a brave new world with millions of billionaire hairdressers. And the Kochs wonder why they're considered kooks.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
A federal court has given the go-ahead to continue controversial warrantless wiretapping procedures first revealed by National Security Agency whistleblower Edward Snowden. The Office of the Director of National Intelligence has declassified the announcement of the program's renewal, which is actively culling metadata from millions of Americans, and ordered it to continue in an unprecedented disclosure. High-ranking government officials and the president have said that the recently disclosed NSA surveillance programs contain protections which safeguard the privacy of Americans. The program is overseen by the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which they say provides effective oversight. Critics say that the mass collection of electronic metadata on phone calls and web activity in the NSA's PRISM program is an overreach by authorities. Snowden remains at an airport in Moscow awaiting news on a temporary asylum plea to Russia while he plans his passage to Venezuela, which has already offered him permanent asylum. In related privacy news, the New York Times is reporting on the increasing trend of car companies placing black boxes in new cars. According to the report, 96% of all new cars contain the black boxes, which record performance information and are used to reconstruct auto accidents. However, some consumers have raised alarm over what exactly the black boxes record and who owns that data. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration wants the recorders to become standard in all new cars.
Republican Senator John McCain has called for a review of controversial Stand Your Ground laws. McCain made the comments while addressing President Obama's recent remarks on the racial nature of George Zimmerman's killing of Trayvon Martin last year in Florida. Zimmerman shot and killed the unarmed Martin after he intercepted him while walking to his father's house in a gated community and said in court that Martin looked suspicious. After a confrontation which led to a fight, Zimmerman killed Martin with a single shot to the chest. Zimmerman was acquitted of murder charges on July 15th, sparking national outrage. Defense lawyers did not use the Stand Your Ground laws in Zimmerman's case, but the broad laws pushed by gun groups which allow people who fear they may be threatened to fire on others without needing to retreat have come under criticism since Martin's killing. McCain's home state of Arizona is one of 30 with a Stand Your Ground law. He points to economic disparities experienced by communities of color as evidence of a culture which discriminates against African Americans.
The British government is taking steps to ban internet porn. announced by Prime Minister David Cameron during a speech today, the move will require UK internet service providers to block all pornographic websites. However, British web users can opt out of the block if they wish to watch porn over their own connections. In comments to a children's charity, Cameron said that internet pornography was, quote, corroding childhood. Cameron wants the block in place by the end of the year and hopes to complement it with laws making possession of violent porn a criminal act. Cameron's definition of violent porn includes scenes depicting simulated rape or child pornography. While anti-porn critics applauded the move, those opposed to this suggested measures say they result in censorship. Critics also noted that videos of consensual acts by adults, especially those with boundary-pushing content, would be criminalized. They say an infringement of protected speech.
Over the weekend, I had the pleasure of attending the Oregon Health and Science University's first annual Neuroscience Symposium downtown. After listening to several talented minds address the nation's top neural health issues, I spoke with Damien Fair, principal investigator of behavioral neuroscience at OHSU. In 2012, Fair's department received national recognition for their research. His lecture this past weekend discussed the current research trends in ADHD recognition and treatment.
So, Damien, first of all, thanks for joining us. And could you mention how ADHD is regulated in developing brains?
Currently, we don't necessarily know what the brain mechanisms that correspond to ADHD are. There are certainly lots of theories about what those are, but we currently don't know. We think that one of the reasons why that might be is because we tend to treat or try to identify who has ADHD simply based on symptoms, you know, which would be hyperactivity, impulsivity, poor inattention, things like that. These are certain types of behaviors. But there may be lots of different brain mechanisms that may lead to these types of behaviors. So part of our work is trying to determine if we can better stratify, better individualize the direct causes of the disorder in a given child.
Absolutely. And actually, that brings up an interesting question, is what would be the key tools for an early intervention? Like, how could you tell if a child has ADHD or they're just being hyperactive? Because, I mean, can you tell at age two, or do they need to be at least 5 years old? What's the general age that you can earliest detect symptoms of ADHD?
Well, currently, you know, school age is the age at which ADHD can be diagnosed. It's very difficult to diagnose the disorder much younger. That is one of the reasons why the work that we're doing at OHSU and other places around the world, indeed, using non-invasive tools like brain imaging, is part of the goal is to see if we're able to assess the atypical developmental trajectory much earlier that may lead to some earlier interventions. But currently based on behaviors and reporting from parents and teachers, school age is typically the age that ADHD is diagnosed.
Is it more common in boys or girls? Is there a gender difference in ADHD prevalency?
There is some gender differences tend to occur in boys more than girls, but both genders are affected by the disorder.
Well, Damien, I know you're doing more up-and-coming research. What would you say in response to kind of that common criticism? I believe it was in the 90s when all the kids were getting diagnosed with ADHD, regardless of whether they had. There was a happy trigger diagnosis factor going amongst the American school children of ADHD. What would be your response to that criticism over like an overly abundant amount of diagnosis?
Well, this is one of the big difficulties with not just ADHD, but all types of mental disorders that we know of now, is that it's very much different than other disorders that we're familiar with, things like diabetes or heart disease, where we have very specific tests to be able to determine whether someone has a disorder or not. It's based simply, for the most part, on signs and symptoms and not a specific diagnostic.
Okay.
And so what that can lead to is some overclassification of ADHD, but also some underclassification of the disorder, too, where folks aren't getting properly evaluated. And we think that these non-invasive tools like brain imaging And there's even a new FDA-approved EEG and other non-invasive tools that we may be at a crux of time where we're able to actually generate some basic markers for the disorder that will help alleviate some of that concern.
Now, with advancements in technology, can I ask, is ADHD kind of considered a modern epidemic in comparison to, what might have occurred 50 years ago? And if so, what's happening now to cause such a prevalence? Is it just because we're categorizing? Is this before we would call them, paying attention? Or are there developments in technology, like the entertainment industry? Like, what factors are affecting this? Because it seems to be a much more modern epidemic comparatively.
Right. Well, this is, the prevalence and the rates of prevalence for these types of disorders can be very difficult to assess over time, which I think is what you're hinting at. And that's because it's not that ADHD per se is a new phenomena, but that the way we categorize and appreciate the disorder is much different. So, 50 years ago, 60 years ago, even longer, the folks would have been categorized as something different than ADHD, even though they still had it. It doesn't mean that the prevalence of the disorder isn't increasing or changing over time, but it's very difficult to disambiguate between how we classify a specific disorder and whether and how it's increasing in prevalence over time. But we think some of these new measurements that are being developed now will help with that.
Okay. Now, Damien, you're a local guy. I remember going to that neuroscience symposium and seeing lecturers from all over the U.S., but you're from OHSU. I don't know. I think you've been in Portland for a while, if I'm not mistaken. And, I mean, have you yourself been involved in any school studies in the area, local activities, or do you have any relevant community events or organizations you've been involved with concerning ADHD and spreading awareness for it, that if people like myself or parents would want to know more about it, where could they go? Is there anything that you're involved in?
Yes. So we are involved in some outreach and community education initiatives to help folks better understand and get more acquainted. Where a lot of the work that we do is dependent on community participation, so we try to give back to the community in outreach efforts as well. We have a program that runs out of our lab called the Youth Engaged in Science Program. It's multifaceted in many respects, but the primary idea is to help expose younger disadvantaged youth the type of work that we do, so they can recognize that over time that these are career options for them as well. Get them exposed to our work and the investigators and the research environment, things of this nature. But also part of this program is we have community forums, community events, or we have experts from OHSU and really some of the best in the world that relate to ADHD, like a co-collaborator, Joel Nigg, Eric Von Bahn, who does autism work. Where we go to the community and discuss who we are, what we do, and then allow folks in the community to ask questions that a lot of folks have. We've recently done one of these events at Highland Christian Church, and we will be having more planned. But if folks are interested in getting more information about work, about the disorders, about connecting with the various investigators who are experts, or experts in the disorders, or experts like myself in neuroimaging. We do have an email, yes@ohsu.edu. That's yes@ohsu.edu, and that's kind of a triage area where we can help get folks connected.
Sounds like you've done this before. I was going to ask for the contact information, but you're one step ahead of me. So unless you have any questions or any relevant topics that I haven't addressed, thanks so much for taking the time to speak with us.
No problem, Matt, and thank you.
Thank you so much, Damien.
A damaged General Electric reactor at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant in Japan unexpectedly began releasing steam late last week. The steam is an indicator of the fragile state of the plant more than 2 years after the tsunami and a resultant nuclear disaster there. This latest news adds to the growing list of problems at the plant, including indications that radioactive water has been leaking into the ocean since the disaster. A spokesman for the plant hypothesized that rainwater seepage may have turned to vapor because of heat inside the reactor.
A Turkish court has ruled in favor of plans to demolish Istanbul's Gezi Park. In May, the Turkish Prime Minister's plans to convert the space into a shopping mall sparked violent national protests, which left 6 people dead and thousands injured. Protesters won a temporary reprieve as a regional court ordered a halt to the park's demolition. Today's ruling by the city's first administrative court follows a complaint by the Istanbul Tourism Ministry. Legal observers are unsure as to the effects of the opposing rulings. Last month, protesters were forcibly evicted by tear gas and water cannon-wielding riot police. Protesters are expected to gather at the park again this weekend.
In the latest news from U.S.-occupied Afghanistan, a man was killed and 10 others injured today when two blasts rocked the village of Chaman near the Pakistan-Afghan border, Geo News reports. Sources confirmed that several people were injured in the blast, after which vehicular traffic to Afghanistan was suspended. Two civilians were killed and 4 were wounded yesterday when their vehicle struck a roadside bomb in the southern Afghan province of Kandahar. The incident took place when their vehicle hit a bomb in the Joy Lahore area of the Argandab district, according to government spokesman Jawed Faisal. At least 6 people were killed in 2 bomb attacks believed to be carried out by Taliban forces in Afghanistan's Helmand province, police said. At least 13 others were injured in the blasts Friday evening after a pair of Taliban raids in Helmand's Marja district, one of the more restive areas of Afghanistan, Afghan police told the Kaman Press.
And now we go to the latest news and developments from the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Monday, July 22nd, 2013. Armed Israeli settlers attack Palestinian villagers and troops invade West Bank communities. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. An Israeli army court decided on Monday to extend the detention of Mu'min al-Attili for 8 days and revoked his rights to see a lawyer. Al-Attili is a Palestinian judge from Attil village near the northern West Bank city of Tul Karim. He was kidnapped on Sunday by Israeli troops manning a military checkpoint between his village and Tul Karim city. The army gave no reason for detaining Al-Attili. Elsewhere, Israeli army forces invaded the village of Zaytun al-Ka'abna near the southern West Bank city of Hebron on Monday morning. The Israeli forces searched and ransacked homes. Soldiers also gave residents demolishing orders for an animal house and a grocery store. The troops claim that the two structures are built without the required military permission that is rarely given to Palestinian villagers. Also on southern West Bank, family members of Palestinian political detainees held by Israel and local activists protested on Monday in Bethlehem City. Protesters gathered at the Manager Square near the Church of Nativity and demanded that the Israeli army release all political detainees. They also called on international community to force Israel to halt its ill treatment of those prisoners. In other news, on Sunday, a group of armed Israeli settlers attacked the Palestinian Bedouin villages of Umm al-Harim and Rahma in the Negev Desert. According to local residents, the right-wing Israelis attacked the villagers' livestock, shouted racial slurs at them, and damaged their property. The attackers also set fire to a tent that belonged to a local resident, according to the head of the village council. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was the Monday, July 22nd news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by Seamus Sloan-White and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032.
Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Kevin Dugan, Mike Kepfler, Joe Meyer, John Rasmussen, and Robin Ryan. Special thanks to Ren Green. The producer is Ross Freeman-Levin. Our engineer is Danielle Parks. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Drinka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews.
If you'd like to call your elected representatives about any issue you've heard on the news tonight, here are the phone numbers, so get a pen or something to write with. The local number for Senator Ron Wyden is 503-326-7525. The number for Senator Jeff Merkley is 503-326-3386. And Portland Mayor Charlie Hales can be reached at 503-823-4120. You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River 91.9 FM. I'm John Rasmussen.
And I'm Angelique O'Rourke. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show with Abe Proctor and Joe Uris. At 9, on Alternative Radio, Chris Hedges speaks on corporate coup d'etat. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary.
At 10:15, it's Flashpoints and Guest Fate of News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 on stage and studio, host D-May Roberts talks with members of the production of San Shepard's True West at Our Shoes Are Red, The Performance Lab. And we'll have a commentary by Eastern Oregon writer Bing Bingham. And at 11:30 on Art Focused, host Joseph Gallivan, the curator of graphic arts at the Portland Art Museum, Mary Weaver Chapin, will speak with about artist books.
Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support in our special flash drive on Friday. If you missed it, you can still donate by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today.
Stay tuned now for more national and international news from the Worker-Run Collective at Free Speech Radio News. Good night, Angelique.
Good night, John.
This is Free Speech Radio News for Monday, July 22nd, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Doran Marina. Coming up, secret internal documents from the Pakistan government record civilians killed, including dozens of children, in U.S. drone strikes. As thousands rally across the country for Trayvon Martin, we'll take a look at a renewed push to free Marissa Alexander, a survivor of domestic violence sentenced to 20 years in prison in a shooting case where no one was injured. And in a ruling that could have implications for government leaks and journalistic freedom, a federal appeals court finds that a reporter can be compelled to testify against sources. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSR and Headlines. A federal judge has temporarily delayed the implementation of a North Dakota law that would ban all abortion as soon as a fetal heartbeat is detected. U.S. District Judge Daniel Hovland called the law clearly invalid and unconstitutional. Passed earlier this year, the measure is one of a suite of laws that combined are the most restrictive reproductive rights laws in the U.S. Fetal heartbeats can be detected as early as 6 weeks of pregnancy. Many women aren't aware they're pregnant until much later in their first trimester. U.S. Border Patrol agents detained 8 undocumented youth today as they tried to re-enter the United States at a border crossing at Nogales, Arizona. The youth were all wearing graduation caps and gowns. The Dream 8 were all brought to the U.S. as young children and have lived nearly all their lives in the country. Most of them were forced to leave the U.S. prior to President Obama's declaration of Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. The program creates an opportunity for undocumented youth to legally remain in the country and is issued at the discretion of the Department of Homeland Security. A crowd of supporters, including a coalition of clergy, massed on the U.S. side of the border. The youth are asking to be allowed back into the U.S. to reunite with their families under DACA's so-called humanitarian parole provision. Local elections in India's West Bengal state continued today. Because of both the size and the population of the area, the country's Supreme Court ordered that the poll be held in five phases. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari reports that at least 20 people have died during unprecedented electoral violence.
Eight people died in today, including a woman who had just cast her ballot. The deaths come amid clashes and firing by security forces during the fourth phase of elections in four state districts. The first phase of the rural government or panchayat elections was held July 11th in the Maoist hit areas and was peaceful. But political chaos has accompanied the next three phases, including bombings and gunfire between political opponents. The polls will elect representatives for the three committees that oversee development in rural areas. Opposition parties say the ruling Trinamool Congress, TMC, and the state government are responsible for the violence. Manas Bhuiya is senior Congress leader.
Up to third phase, 15 people were killed. Now the killing is continuing, and this is due to law and order deteriorating situation, and it is indulged by the state government and the ruling TMC.
But Chief Minister Mamata Banerjee has blamed the opposition for trying to disrupt the polls. She says the State Election Commission conducts the elections and has enough security forces to contain the violence. Prabhakar Mani Tiwari, FSRN, Kolkata.
In Zimbabwe today, dozens of demonstrators stormed the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission's main offices, demanding their rights to vote under the country's new constitution. Gerikai Chaunza explains.
The protesters arrived at the Zimbabwe Electoral Commission or ZEC offices singing in vernacular Tinoda Kuvota, meaning we want to vote. Under laws implemented in 2000, anyone born in Zimbabwe to a parent who held citizenship in other country was officially classified as an alien and denied the right to vote. Under the new constitution, this practice is expressly prohibited. Voting rights advocate Kimberly Nyasanga says that these votes are getting the runaround.
We want ZEC to give those people permission to vote because their names, they are already in the voters' room. They are appearing in the voters' room, but they didn't renounce their citizenship.
The protesters are demanding that the commission update their records and issue new identity cards in time for the next week's general elections. Garikai Chaunza, FSRN, Harare.
At least 75 people died in China today when an earthquake struck in Gansu province. According to Xinhua News, more than 1,000 homes were destroyed in the mostly rural region. Rescue and relief operations are ongoing, and rainy weather is expected to hamper those efforts for the next few days. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles.
Don't stop! Don't stop!
Across the country, thousands gathered in dozens of cities to continue the call for justice in the case of the killing of Florida teen Trayvon Martin. Many protesters rallied against gun laws like Stand Your Ground, which critics say is applied unevenly and leads to more violence. Since a nearly all-white jury acquitted George Zimmerman in the shooting of the unarmed teen, protests have taken place daily, and on Saturday, civil rights advocates called for people to gather in front of federal buildings at noon. In New York, Martin's mother, Sabrina Fulton, addressed the crowd.
We supported him, we cared for him, just like you do your kids. The verdict won't stop here. This is another chapter on a different movement. We have moved on from the verdict. Of course we're hurting.
Yeah.
Of course we're shocked and disappointed. But that just means that we have to roll up our sleeves and continue to fight.
Amen.
Sound from the AP. In Oakland, California, about 36 demonstrators, mostly parents and children, gathered outside of the Bay Area Rapid Transit Station and marched to the federal building to join about 200 others. The multicultural and peaceful protests following President Obama's statements on Friday on race are about more than just the shooting of Martin and the acquittal of Zimmerman. Many pointed to racism, inequality, and injustice experienced by many people of color. Another case that's drawing both attention and outrage is the 2-decade prison sentence given to Marissa Alexander, a Florida resident and survivor of domestic violence. In Oakland, residents held a separate rally calling for her to be freed. FSRN's Sharon Sobota has more.
Free Marissa! Free Marissa!
Dozens of people gathered at Oscar Grant Plaza to call for the release of Marissa Alexander, a mother of three who was sentenced to 20 years in prison for firing a warning shot into the wall in an effort to stop her husband, Rico Gray, who was threatening her. Gray had a history of domestic abuse with multiple women, which he admitted to in a deposition, yet Alexander failed in her bid to use the state's Stand Your Ground law, even though no one was hurt in the 2010 incident. Demonstrators marched around Lake Merritt to spread awareness about Alexander, a case which some say hasn't gotten enough attention. Bay Area activist Lauren Riott helped to organize the rally.
The hypocrisy of this case really started to make the news when Zimmerman was acquitted. And so while there were actions back in 2012, there hasn't been a lot of support for her since, at least nationally. I know that there's been local support and support from her family. And so this is sort of to bring awareness back to her case because it hasn't stopped being, you know, horrible and unfair and really terrifying to other mothers.
In 2011, a judge denied a motion to dismiss the charges of aggravated assault with a deadly weapon under the state's Stand Your Ground law. Although Alexander